UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this special episode of the UEG Talks. In this episode, we are covering the best of UEG week in Vienna recently and the highlights related to IBD, inflammatory bowel disease. IBD seemed to dominate this year's UEG week with so many amazing sessions on this topic and huge presence at the industry stands by big IBD companies. I think we've moved on from the days of just using thiopurines and anti-TNFs as a treatment for IBD to a totally new world in the IBD therapeutic field. Now, I always believe having choice is important, but I think having a choice overload makes it very hard to make decisions. And that's true in every aspect of life. And that's what boiled down to IBD therapeutics these days, with choices seem endless, a year on year, basically. And this is especially made difficult by the fact that the efficacy of most advanced IBD treatment seems to sit at a similar level. So it's very confusing for us clinicians how to select these IBD therapies. Now, I did cover this similar episode with Tim Raine last year, and we were very excited about risankizumab data. A year on, risankizumab has become a mainstream, and actually it's become an old drug already. So there seemed to be a never-ending streak of new drugs in this field. So from my perspective as a non-IBD specialist, me personally, I would like to have more knowledge on how to make decisions on IBD therapy, and probably like to see more in the field of maybe something like a targeted treatment, maybe with some molecular markers or genetic markers or phenotypic markers to target treatment for better efficacy. I'm sure these 4 days in Vienna, there was plenty of these things was covered, and I was very gutted that I could not attend many of these sessions. And I'm very much looking forward to this episode, my conversation with our guest today. We'll try to summarize what was the best and what probably listeners should go back and watch some of the episodes which are online from the UEG Week in Vienna. So to discuss today is our guest, eminent Dr. Iris Dutton, who's a consultant gastroenterologist and director of gastroenterology at Rabin Medical Center in Israel and a faculty at Tel Aviv University. Welcome to the show, Iris.
Hi, Pradeep. Thank you for having me.
Iris, let me start by maybe you can highlight probably the most groundbreaking study that was presented. And why do you think it would be groundbreaking in this day and age?
Yeah. So thank you for asking this, Pradeep, because I think you touched an important point. This year, I personally found UEGW, the groundbreaking part of UEGW was that there was no one groundbreaking study, like you mentioned in your discussion from last year with Tim. This year, the groundbreaking part in my perception was the deep dive into molecules you mentioned, the industry. So into molecules that were already introduced and mechanisms of action that we know mainly and were already approved for use. So we had a deeper dive into, for instance, you mentioned from last year, risankizumab. So this year we were introduced to guselkumab, the anti-IL-23 monoclonal antibody, and it's long-term in the maintenance studies from the QUASAR study, for instance, in patients with ulcerative colitis, showing the long-term effect of it, both clinically, so the efficacy, and also the higher target. So this is what I mean by deeper dive, going not only into clinical efficacy or endoscopic outcomes, but also for histologic and endoscopic healing and even remission in patients with ulcerative colitis, showing after 1 year that about 60% of patients were able to achieve this high level target. So for instance, this is what I see as deeper dive into mechanisms of action that we had already seen. For another example, again, what I mean by deeper dive. So you spoke about risankizumab in patients with Crohn's disease. So last year, we were seeing the comparisons between risankizumab, for instance, and ustekinumab or risankizumab long-term. And this year, we were looking at, I liked specifically data from the Spanish group, the Egeteco and EIDA registry, looking at outcomes of treating patients with Crohn's disease with risankizumab, showing us that in the real world, they were able to have good clinical, in this case, clinical steroid-free remission after 8 to 12 weeks of treating patients that were actually quite sick and with quite long duration, and about half of them were already exposed to previous biologics. So again, going deeper into what we already know. This was my highlight about what was groundbreaking.
Okay. Iris, on that note, you mentioned that in real world, the response or the efficacy seems to be better compared to the trial world. Is that true? Is that correct? Why is that so?
So, by the way, is that true and is that correct? We will have to go and look into all the pivotal trials and their outcomes and compare it to what is real world. And of course, in the real world, you can ask which real world, right? The European, the American, what were the criteria and so on and so forth. However, I will tell you that we are in a paradox, right? On one hand, we say, okay, we cannot pass some ceiling, some therapeutic ceiling, because the pivotal studies, the registration studies show us deltas that are not satisfactory to us as people who treat patients with IBD, as healthcare practitioners who treat patients with IBD. And on the other, exactly like you said, sometimes when we take it to the real world, in the end of the day, we see a very high proportion of patients that are achieving clinical remission. And what is my explanation for this? The explanation, unfortunately, is that both are correct. The pivotal registrational trials usually have very strict patient inclusion criteria, right? We know that only a low percentage of our patients would be eligible into a clinical trial, a company in initiated clinical trial. And usually the endpoints are very strict and very rigorous. So you're looking today at endoscopic remission. You're looking today at histologic healing. You're looking at very strict targets that, of course, when the real world studies are usually looking at clinical, at the most, biomarker and endoscopic outcomes. So this is why sometimes we see, oh, wow, this works wonderfully in the real world. And why doesn't it work like this in the clinical trials? This is one of the explanations.
Okay, yeah, I think that's important for all of us to know. Now, moving on, was there something that was unexpected, which goes against the popular belief that was present in Vienna?
Yeah. So unexpected or popular belief. So I would think a little different than what we used to think. Actually, I will take you to the surgical world. I think one of the interesting pieces of information that we had noticed was discussion about the importance of the mesentery. There was a debate on the mesentery with whether it was friend or foe. And then it was mentioned nicely, you know, what is new in the surgical approaches to inflammatory bowel diseases. And you know that in the last few years, we were thinking maybe surgical approach where the mesentery would be cut out also because it held lymphoid cells that might have an effect on recurrence of Crohn's disease specifically. This was actually looked at both in Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. And in both cases, despite the hype around the mesentery, probably the effect, as was shown, is not as strong and does not justify the bigger surgeries that are associated with the mesentery. So after a few years where we were all around the mesentery, I think that this was something that I said, okay, here is something that we should take into consideration where we discuss surgery, because of course we are not the surgeons.
I thought the findings were there's no need to remove the mesentery, right?
Right.
Excellent. Moving on to any other signs, is there anything that would challenge our clinical practice or maybe give some confidence or advantage to what we already do in standard practice? And any new signs that we can start using straight away in our clinical practice?
Two. things that I would like to discuss. One is regarding nutrition. So this all of us can take to our clinics tomorrow. We see more and more the importance of nutrition in general, of the environment, of course, right? From pollutants to everything that is related to the exposome. But specifically, nutrition is something that we can take to the benefit of our patients tomorrow. And this is related to several abstracts that were presented on the importance of ultra-processed food that is an important component of what we call the Western diet and the Western lifestyle. So ultra-processed food is associated with the risk of developing inflammatory bowel diseases, specifically Crohn's disease, but was also shown that it may be related to better control of flares if you take away the ultra-processed food. So I think this is a theme that is already prevalent and was clear in this UEGW. And to complete this, the importance of the Mediterranean diet and the Mediterranean lifestyle in patients with inflammatory bowel diseases. Again, we have a little more evidence for patients with Crohn's disease. So I think this is something that should be taken into an immediate practice. And we don't need, I think, to wait for the next years until more evidence comes, and it will come. Although it is hard to get the evidence as in a placebo-controlled trial, but we see more and more evidence to suggest on the importance of nutrition, and again, specifically ultra-processed food devoid and Mediterranean-like promoted.
So I'm glad you touched upon the ultra-processed. It's associated with so many adverse health outcomes in every situation, not just IBD. And I think it's very important to focus on that. And I'm glad there was something that was presented to support that at the UEG. I think it's definitely a thing to watch, right? Was there anything particular in terms of the papers, or was it just a sort of general thing?
So there were abstract oral presentations, but also in the moderate posters and in the posters about ultra-processed food and control of flares in patients with Crohn's disease, about a diet without ultra-processed food that is flexible and doesn't necessarily include, you know, formulas like we know about the Crohn's disease diet. So doesn't necessarily adhere patients to formulas and shakes, which is something that sometimes interferes with quality of life. So more flexible diet patterns. And of course, in the general discussions, there was a lot regarding the Mediterranean diet, and in many of the microbiota sessions, there was mention of the Western as opposed to the more healthy / Mediterranean lifestyle that is associated also with microbiota, with changes in the microbiome and the metabolites that we can see usually when we test the feces of patients with Crohn's disease, mainly that are adhering to a more Mediterranean style lifestyle.
Yeah, because we can correlate that with the changing lifestyles and increasing prevalence, which kind of coincides with excessive use of ultra-processed food. Now, I'm more happy that you mentioned, I always tell my fellow every day when he's munching away on his sliced bread sandwich, because I can technically see his mutations developing in front of my eyes. So I'm glad you mentioned that. I'll take this back to my fellow. Thanks, Iris, for that. That was a good one, I thought. Is there any new knowledge that was presented that would change how we use our existing treatments, you know, standard treatments that we always use? Could we use them differently, or is there anything that would add value to our existing management? What we change?
Yeah. So I think here is where we should combine practicalities and evidence. What do I mean specifically in that? There was an abstract, and there were a few actually abstracts about using the drugs that we have today in a different way, exactly like you said. For instance, in patients that are treated with ustekinumab, there was a Dutch prospective cohort that was looking at patients that are treated with ustekinumab and asking whether they could have an interval, if they were stable on an interval of every 8 weeks, could we increase the interval to every 12 weeks? So an extension of our question, can we exit or can we de-escalate or can we stop therapy in patients with inflammatory bowel diseases, which I would not recommend. In this case, the authors say, no, let's just increase the interval and see what happens to patients. And they notice that patients have a comparable outcome, whether they were treated after they were in clinical remission, whether they were treated every 8 weeks with an injection of ustekinumab in this case, or every 12 weeks. Now, you might ask, what do you care about this? It is now when the ustekinumab biosimilars are coming into the market and the price of this is not going to be, so the cost effectiveness, it doesn't matter anymore. So why would you do that? But I would call our attention to the fact that if a patient is being treated with any medication, so it's not about the specific drug, but in this case, it would mean that patient will take an injection every 3 months. That means just a few times a year. So it distances, I think, patients if they remain in clinical remission. And of course, we need to validate that it's also biomarker and endoscopic remission. But if they are indeed in remission, so it means something that you only take 4 injections a year. It distances the patients from the notion of being sick. So I think this is very valuable, even if the cost effectiveness expense-wise is not as important as it may be in the days that we're treating patients with the original drugs. So such attempts to challenge and look at what we do for years because this is how the clinical trials were done or because this is how a drug is approved, I think this is valuable.
Excellent. Okay, so that'll be a good one to possibly think about taking to clinical practice as well, isn't it? I have an etiology question. That's probably because my patients, mostly when I see them in clinic, are first thing interested in, what have I done to get this? So what is it? What can I do to get rid of this? Or what's caused this? And we all want to know that. I think it's very important to know the etiology. Was there anything that helps us to answer this question?
Yes. So here is where I think that you see that usually we say, oh, we are still far away. So of course, we're still far away. But I say yes, because we all have the notion that inflammatory bowel diseases, first of all, are very complex diseases because they represent the interaction of the host and the environment in general, and more specifically of the gut microbiome, which I think can be viewed also as the environment, but everything that is related to exposure, and a mucosal immune system that in a genetically susceptible host is more activated than it should have been. And we have seen a few, I think, abstracts and lectures that related to the roots of this statement of what is IBD. Looking at the environment, we already mentioned in this discussion, nutrition and lifestyle. So if a patient is already genetically susceptible, and you know, when we know that there are so many molecular susceptibility markers that I guess every one of us has a few of them, right? And it depends on the perfect storm, on the moment that a patient or a person that is still not a patient, that is molecularly susceptible, is interacting with an environment that he or she are vulnerable specifically to that environment, whether it is non-steroidal that they're taking, whether it is ultra-processed food in their nutrition, whether it is an infection with some of the viruses. There were some very interesting abstracts on the exposure to viruses and the risk of inflammatory bowel diseases, whether it is extreme stress. I'm sure we will see more and more of that in the coming years. So that together starts a cascade that in the end turns into what we see as the symptoms and the endoscopic findings and the markers that we see as inflammatory bowel disease. How did we get closer to understanding it? First of all, when we were discussing more and more the environment, the pollutants, the food, and everything that we are exposed to. But I found also some very interesting abstracts and lectures about the genetic susceptibility. There was an abstract on somatic mutations and the accumulated somatic mutations that are higher in patients with Crohn's disease and that are higher in areas of inflammation, trying to already decipher the pathways that are specifically relevant for patients with inflammatory bowel diseases. So that was one interesting point related to the pathogenesis. And another were the discussions about where we are trying to learn from our pediatrician colleagues, especially from the situation that is called very early onset IBD, where we already know that monogenic situations are more prevalent in these patients compared to older patients. However, we are able to learn from the very early onset IBD, we're able to learn which molecular pathways are specifically aberrant in patients with inflammatory bowel diseases, and more importantly, to develop specific inhibitors or modifiers of these pathways. Because in the past, we used to say, okay, if it's very early onset IBD, we send the patients to a patient to sequencing, maybe we'll find the pathway, maybe not. And if it's very extreme, one might suggest cell transplantation. But today, that's not always the case. And there are inhibitors from small molecules, inhibitors and new drugs that are developed that are specific for specific pathways. So I think not tomorrow, maybe, but very soon, we will be able to use more and more therapies for these situations. And maybe to send one of my take-home messages from UEG was patients that have very refractory disease, even when they are adults, very refractory disease that does not respond to everything that we know as therapy, especially if they have extraintestinal manifestations, especially if they have several extraintestinal manifestations or unusual extraintestinal manifestations. These are the patients where we should think, okay, maybe we should send them to sequencing and maybe there is a specific pathway and maybe this pathway, maybe not today, but in 2 years from now, we will be able to help that specific patients with really precision or personalized medicine.
I was thinking you might come to me and say, yeah, they've made this groundbreaking discovery that this particular bug caused something, but of course not.
No, not yet. Not that I noticed. You tell me if you noticed.
Right. So I guess a sort of general advice in every aspect in terms of managing life, you know, reducing stress and managing diet or mental well-being, physical well-being, all these probably, hopefully, will contribute to better control. So, okay, I just come across some new drugs and I couldn't recognize the name. So forgive me for my ignorance here. Can you highlight any new drugs that we should watch out for?
Yeah. So I think if we want to pick up one mechanism of action, I think that our attention should go towards the tumor necrosis factor like ligand 1, so TL1A to be shorter. There were actually several studies, several abstracts on different monoclonal antibodies blocking TL1A in patients with moderately to severely active ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. So this may be valuable in both diseases. And in both cases, there was dose ranging studies that are still finding, trying to look for the right dosages, but already showing signs of efficacy in patients that are treated with these monoclonal antibodies. So I think that the TL1A in ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease is something that we're going to see more and more of. So if you're asking about new drugs in the neighborhoods that might come. And talking about, maybe we should go back to your first question about groundbreaking. So it's still not groundbreaking in IBD, but it was in healthy volunteers mostly. But I think we discussed a few years ago the bispecific antibodies, and I found it interesting. There was an abstract this year talking about orally delivered bispecific antibody construct that neutralized TNF-alpha and interleukin-23. And so this was in healthy subjects trying to show its activity in the GI tissues. So I think this was exciting, talking about not necessarily new mechanism of action, but combining mechanisms of action that we know that are very effective into an orally provided drug and together bispecific antibodies. So I think this is something to look forward to, hoping that it will be valuable for patients with inflammatory bowel diseases. Maybe this is a way to break the therapeutic ceiling.
Excellent, Iris. That was an excellent summary of I think what we needed to know from UG Week in a short space. I'm afraid we don't have much time. I wish I could go on for another half an hour discussing various things in detail, but I would advise the listeners to access the recorded, everything's recorded from the UG Week. Anyone who's registered we'll have access to go back and see all these abstracts, see all the presentations. So I strongly encourage listeners to do that. Iris, anything else to say at all before we conclude?
Yeah, first of all, thank you for having the opportunity to discuss and digest, right? Digest the best. I think that UEG is always exciting. It always keeps you up to date. And there is so much to see. I think that the most common complaint, quote unquote, that we hear, and I'm sure you hear it from the fellows as well, or from anyone, that I was not able to see everything. I was not able to go and look into everything, and what a pity it is. And I always say, that's fine. It's like, it is like a candy store. And as you alluded to, first of all, if you can't make it, you can hear it later on in podcasts like this, or if you log on to the website and see the recordings of everything. So I think this is, first of all, thank you. And to try and adapt to ourselves, I think that as healthcare practitioners, I think that some of the topics that we discussed here, lifestyle, Mediterranean, or whatever your choice of healthy, evidence-based diet is, to try and reduce stress in our stressful world, and to try and convey some of the, not to smoke, of course, and to try and convey some of this to our patients, I think will contribute to them. And in the future, we'll see more and more evidence on that, I'm convinced. And also to us as human beings, I think we should take care of ourselves as well. I think this is a good way to think and to end this talk.
Yes, I think it's linked to all chronic diseases. Iris, thank you so much for taking time. You said you were on holiday this week. I hope you enjoy the rest of your holiday.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Pradeep. Such a pleasure to speak to you.
Thanks for coming.